She was dancing and doing sign language to an all-instrumental show. It was really awesome. And just really cool to see, too, how much can happen when you just say, like, act on instinct, like, you and you, I have a feeling. Just talk to each other, and then you completely step back.
That was M. Pirro reflecting on her approach to organizing the Fringe over the last 5 years. I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
And I'm Nancy Fowler, and this is Cut and Paste. This is Pirro's last year with the Fringe. She started it in 2011. It's a 9-day festival of a variety of acts that take place on stages all over Grand Center. And her thing, as she says, is just to bring all kinds of people together in strange ways and see what kind of artistic collision happens.
Like, along those lines, it's also really experimental, but it's really fun, too. You know, you'll see familiar faces and total strangers and experience something probably unlike you've experienced before.
And speaking of experiences, so Em came in here. We kind of ambushed her with a couple of clips from Fringe acts over the years. And I don't know, there have been dozens, if not more than 100, and kind of had her play a guessing game. But first, we're going to have her tell us exactly what St. Lou Fringe is.
St. Lou Fringe is an organization that supports independent artists. So there are a series of platforms through which we connect with people who have an artistic voice, and our goal is to give them means through which that voice can be expressed. So that ranges from people who are full-time professional artists who just want more means and outlets to present their work, also to total newcomers to the industry who just need a little guidance, need a little perspective, or need a little bit of foundation underneath them. I sometimes like to describe us as the tech incubator for performing artists with our new kind of Silicon Prairie identity in St. Louis. We are to performing artists what like Cortex is to technology incubation.
So, I mean, you've been doing this for 5 years. Why is now the time to leave?
Ah, this is an excellent question. It's interesting because often people will come to me and say, oh, it must be so hard for you to leave your baby, blah, blah, blah. And I'm always like, it's not my baby. It's not a person. It's an entity. And from the very beginning, I've had an out plan. You know, I had a lot of ideas. I had a lot of energy basically to put behind getting the thing off the ground. And it was never my intention to own it. It's a project that serves other people. And it is, there are many people who are at the helm of it, not just me. I am the primary advocate at this time, but it was never designed to be leveraged by a single person.
So the Fringe will continue.
The Fringe will continue. It will grow, it evolve, it will completely change. Of course, my thumbprint is pretty deeply entrenched in it, but so are many other people's, and many more will come to follow.
So you're going where?
I am going, at least for a short while, to Toronto. Yeah, which I've never been to, but I hear it's cool.
That's a great reason.
Exactly. And it's very, very different from any other place I've ever lived. And there's, you know, just kind of an opportunity arose. I was, interested in getting kind of a change of environment, a change of perspective and things like that. And I was looking all at Southern Hemisphere places and I ended up in Toronto. So, you know, whatever that means.
So be a different wardrobe.
In the winter specifically, yeah, which I'm not looking forward to. But I have heard that it's kind of unlike, you know, any other place, which is exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah, I've heard it has a really good arts community. Is there anything that's going on there in particular that you're excited about checking out?
The main thing that's drawing me there is grad school, so I'm really excited for that opportunity to kind of focus my thoughts in a new way and to be challenged and for my perspective and kind of worldview to be challenged. As far as the arts, I hear that Toronto just has a really vibrant scene, so I'm just excited to see what that cultural voice is. And then I've also heard really great things about Montreal, which is about the distance from Toronto that Chicago is from St. Louis. So not super close, but close enough to be able to go and have a little bit of immersion. So a lot of like different kind of cultural exposure going on there that I'm excited to experience.
What will you be studying and where?
Yeah, so I'm going to be going to York University. And I will be studying, the program is called Theater and Performance Studies. So it's actually more of an academic approach to theater and performance that's defined really broadly in this program. And the thing that I like the most about it is that you can choose to pair that study with another discipline. So for example, I might focus on theater and urban planning, or theater and anthropology, or theater and environmental studies. There's a ton of options.
I'm a little curious. I just want to ask one question before we get into a couple other things, which is that, like you mentioned, your thumbprint is possibly firmly placed on St. Louis Fringe. What is that thumbprint?
My kind of value system, and my aesthetic tends to be very focused on interactivity and community. So I tend to focus on that process first and foremost. How do we introduce people or like kind of create a structure that allows for collisions, social collisions, interpersonal collisions, patron and performer collisions, performer-performer collisions, different disciplines of artists interacting with each other? That is, I think, kind of my characteristic, you know, thing that I bring to the organization.
So let's find out whether or not this first clip we're going to play you actually speaks to what you're talking about.
I saw a look of recognition come over your face at one point. What's going on here?
That's from Gateway Opera, isn't it? The Golden Goose, I think, was the name of the show. So that was a show our second year, I want to say. And it was a young, it was at the helm of this young local woman who loves opera and who sings with the local symphony chorus and the St. Louis chorus. I'm not really in the music world, so I'm not sure exactly what everything's called, but she wrote this opera. She and her husband wrote this opera together, and then they performed it. And it was this really interesting kind of, I don't know a lot about opera, but seeing it, it called a lot of kind of classic archetypical opera themes, but was this totally modern, like completely like 2013 relevant, like young couple doesn't know what to do with their lives. He's unemployed. They're like in their like layman's clothes, you know, plaid t-shirt or whatever it is. And then this like mystical kind of beautiful like goose soprano woman like comes in and is just singing. And like it's this classical fable that they've like modernized while using this like high art form. It was a really cool project. I thought it was fantastic. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what are they? Are they singing to an egg, Elma?
I know. In that show, they were singing. So the whole premise, it's a classic story of this poor family who find a golden goose or a goose, a regular goose, and she's laying them golden eggs. So they have like this like unending supply of wealth, but they end up getting greedy and they want to see if she'll produce more quickly. And she's not producing as quickly as they want.
I remember that fairy tale.
Yeah. And they end up killing the goose and then they have nothing. So they were singing to the golden egg.
Oh, they were singing to the golden egg. Yeah. Okay.
It's adorable, okay. Kind of.
It is.
Absolutely.
In a kind of unsettling kind of way.
Should we hear another?
And if you don't know what it is, don't worry about it.
I bet that's Kayla's music show.
Yes, that is exactly what it is.
Yes.
Oh my God, Kayla. She's so cool. Yeah, she's an experimental performance artist who came down from Chicago. So I'm just thinking about her show and it's making me laugh. It was so weird in like all the best ways. Yeah, that video pretty much sums up Kayla in a nutshell. It has, here's the thing. That video has absolutely nothing to do with her show. And that's all you need to know.
So, was this performed at Fringe or no?
Yeah, it was. She, this, like, at one point, it was so weird. I couldn't even tell you what the show was about. At one point, she like left the stage and came back dressed in drag as the world's worst magician, and was just for like probably 15 minutes did cheesy like magic tricks. At one point, she like handed someone a raisin and he ate it, and it was like this so weird, so surreal, but like she was so committed to it. It was like you left. I remember this so clearly. I had a volunteer who went to see it. And she came out and she had this like dazed expression on her face. And she was like, I just saw Kayla's music show. And I was like, was it good? And she goes, I think so. And it was one of those things where you can tell that Kayla is a brilliantly creative mind, wonderful performer, and is really pushing the audience to form an opinion, which I think is so integral to what Fringe stands for.
I was going to ask you what sort of threads there are between Kayla's music show and then this, like, miniature opera. And are there any?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you started by asking me, is kind of my impression or thumbprint on any of this? And I would say yes and no. I would say no because in my role, I feel very strongly that my job is not to intervene with the artistic voice. So my job is to form a platform and to create access points. And in that way, there's a very common thread that you have someone who wants to produce this contemporary opera, and you have someone who just wants to experiment. And both of their shows actually were performed in the same venue. So you could have seen them back to back in the same space. And there's this total transformation of content for the audience. You know, you have no idea what to expect. The through line, I think, is that passion to bring something to the public with some kind of intention, with some kind of expected outcome, and just to like see, just to tease a response. So in that way, I think there's a formal continuity between the two of them.
Do you have a sense of how this has maybe shaken up the St. Louis arts community, or maybe better connected the St. Louis art community, or what would you say has been the impact?
I'm going to kind of think backwards a little bit. I'll start by saying I had coffee with a colleague in the community when we were first beginning to undergo the search for a new director. And she kept asking me, she was asking me as many people have, like, oh, is it hard for you to see your baby go kind of thing? And I said, no, it's not. I was like, and it's going to completely change. I totally recognize that. I think that's good. I think that's healthy. But the only thing that will make me sad is if it doesn't survive. That's the only thing that would be hard for me, is if no one really takes it and runs with it. And she said, there's no way that's going to happen. It's here to stay. And that was such a powerful thing for me to hear, because from my perspective, I don't see that. I see like the work and the drive that goes into keeping the thing alive. I don't really see like the broader perspective of, is this seen as a local institution, or is it seen as something that's valuable and embedded in the community? And so hearing that from an outside voice was really affirming. As far as has the local community changed, when we started, the idea was, you know, kind of planted many years ago, but really started taking hold in mid-2011. And at that time, there was really a sense of fragmentation and isolation within the community. There was not a lot of collaboration. In fact, early on, 2007, when I had first teased the idea, I was told, don't do it, it'll never work because people don't want to work together. And I think that has now, nearly 10 years later, has completely changed. And I think there's still fragmentation just systematically in St. Louis, and that's reflected within the sub-communities as well, of course. But there is such an intentional and like approach and a new sense of open-mindedness about working together in a way that I don't think there was before. I don't think that that's singularly dependent on Fringe, but I do think that Fringe contributed to that at a pivotal time.
Was it part of a groundswell that was kind of happening organically as well?
Absolutely. And that was part of the reason that we started it when we did. Like I mentioned, we had the idea in 2007, and it was clear that that wasn't the right time. And when we introduced it again in 2011, there were many factors that kind of paved the way for Fringe. The Alley Cat Review that ended up turning into the local burlesque scene that really driving like the local kind of performing arts culture for a while was definitely an indicator to us that this seemed like a natural, you know, successive step. Same thing with the Kevin Kline Awards. That the Kevin Kline Awards ended up folding like a week before our first festival. And so this seemed like they seem like two really different things, like a kind of Tony Award style professional theater thing versus a Fringe, but really they were kind of a natural sequence. And then now, of course, there's other things that continue to celebrate the arts.
Sure.
But if those things hadn't happened first, then we would have never been able to do what we did the way that we did it, or have it be received the way that it was. And if we hadn't done the things that we do, there's a number of other projects that would never have been able to take hold in the same way. So it all falls within a life cycle.
So wait, if the Kevin Kline Awards hadn't folded, then that would have impeded Fringe being successful? Is that what you're saying?
Or? Not necessarily. I think that was just kind of timing.
Okay.
I think that the Kevin Kline's had served their purpose. The Kevin Kline's probably could have continued. There's a number of different factors that went into them not sustaining. But a lot of it was that I think the thing that the Kevin Kline's did that, from my experience, hadn't happened before, at least within this kind of generation of theater artists, was they brought people together in a way that wasn't happening. You know, they did it through having this kind of competitive framework, but which wasn't really that competitive. And it basically just put people in a room together to celebrate their craft.
So that set the stage for a collaboration.
Exactly.
Kind of.
Exactly.
So okay.
And I'm curious about that, Nancy, from your perspective, too, because when I showed up, I felt like, although there's, you know, people have their favorite institutions or their favorite companies that they follow, you'd see, you know, as we just heard, we'd see like an opera singer show up at Fringe to do a piece, or, you know, the actors themselves kind of knew each other, even if they weren't necessarily performing in the same venues. And to me, that looked like a kind of cohesiveness, but I don't know if that's the case or what your experience has been of it as well.
Well, it does seem like the local theater and performance scene has exploded with younger people, I would say, in the last 10 years. And they maybe came up with a better sense of being collaborators, perhaps, and maybe all these things work together. Would you say that's true, Em?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think there's also some key institutions that are driving that. I think the theater program at SIUE and the theater program at St. Louis University drive a lot of that collaborative spirit and tie into a lot of local institutions. So, you know, you look at the bios of students in Fompon as well. There's a lot of higher education that is focusing really intentionally on collaborative work and on empowering young artists to be involved.
And so we're talking a lot about kind of collaborations across different genres of art and different types of performance. Do you ever bring in hip hop or any contemporary musics?
Just right before I came here, I ran into Marty Stepney, who is a local b-boy who I've worked with on several different projects. He was part of the artist salon that we did last month, where that's very much like, that's something that has my thumbprint all over it. It's all this kind of like mashup style where we take artists of completely different medium and are like, we're going to throw you in a room together and you can't leave and you got to be nice to each other and like make it work. And so we put Marty in a room with a didgeridoo player and an opera singer from Cleveland. And he was doing breakdancing and she was singing a mix of classical opera, experimental opera, and pop covers like Prince, and then the didgeridoo was kind of providing this like percussive undertone. It was really cool. And Marty and DJ Wiz buddied up with Miss Jubilee and the Lindy Hoppers, the St. Louis Jitterbugs, and they did this whole mashup where they were looking at the continuity between music history and social dance and how jazz and swing dance had really laid the groundwork for what later became hip-hop and breakdancing.
Oh, wow.
And how they both have a lot of shared social rules. And we did this night that was a mashup between the two where they were playing with each other's musical genres and dance disciplines and interacting with each other. It was amazing. It was incredible. Like, just to see that stuff just blossom was awesome.
So then when you do a project like that, does that then have voice at some point in the Fringe, or is that kind of part of just developing the ethos?
That's a really good question. And that's where I think Fringe is kind of flexibly defined. So the festival itself has some kind of rules to the trade that are maintained, you know, nationally within the North American continent and within the world. But outside of that, there's a reason that our organization is called St. Louis Fringe and not the St. Louis Fringe Festival, because the festival is just one asset of what we do. And I keep those rules pretty firm as far as like we don't impede with the artistic aesthetic. We create a platform for artists to have their own voice. Outside of that, though, we can play. So we get this like great network of artists who come to us with that ethos that I described about Kayla and Gateway Opera, that have this kind of sense of experimentation and you know, this kind of desire to do things that are new and different and challenging. And then we leverage those relationships that we build and introduce them to each other to hopefully strengthen the community, strengthen them as individual artists, strengthen the experience, strengthen or magnify maybe the cultural voice of St. Louis by forging these connections that aren't happening organically.
So can you give us an example of the way like two very different kinds of music might mash up in a Fringe
Yeah,
show?
I think that DJ Wiz and Miss Jubilee is a great example where we had, you know, like a kind of 90s, late 90s style like hip hop DJ and literally vintage jazz live. And so you've got like one guy at a computer and, you know, a live band, and they're figuring out ways on the fly to work together. Yeah, we've had some other interesting kind of collaborations. One of the most interesting collaborations I think we had was our first year. Again, two artists who just showed up, didn't know each other, and we were like, I just have a feeling you guys should talk. We do that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. This was a poet and performance artist who is deaf. And
Sabina England. Yes.
And Bryson Gerard, who played the bouzouki, which is a traditional Greek instrument made out of a gourd, but he played it like slash, Like, he would, like, shred on this thing, and it sounded, like, amazing. He would hook it up to, like, these electronic, you know, effects or whatever, and we paired them together. And so you had this, like, literally a deaf artist in an entirely instrumental show, you know, an entirely audio show working together. And they had this whole thing about, like, the vibration of the music and physical cues, and she was dancing and doing sign language to an all-instrumental show. It was really awesome. And just really cool to see, too, how much can happen when you just say, like, act on instinct, like, you and you, I have a feeling. Just talk to each other, and then you completely step back. And what they come up with, I think, is often so much more powerful than what happens when you try to interject or force something to happen.
Now, your successor has been named. Who is that?
Yes, Matthew Kearns.
Do you have a sense that you have kind of been a maestro in this pairing of very, you know, diverse people? Do you think he'll have that same sort of a sense?
Matt's aesthetic is completely different from mine, which I think is going to be really good and fresh. So he'll, you know, carry over what he wants to, basically, and then he's got a whole platform of new ideas. His story, I think, is really interesting. First of all, his background is very different from mine. My background was in social work and community development and as a performer. He went to architecture school. He was an educator for 20 years. He's been a producer all over the country. He did an experimental theater master's program. So his whole kind of life narrative is really, really significantly different than mine. So he's going to bring a whole different value system and toolbox. I think the most interesting thing about Matt is that he lived away from St. Louis. He's from here. He's from North County. He lived away for 20 years, and he came back after he heard that there was a Fringe Festival. So he came back and produced in our second year. And I remember him taking me aside one day and being like, when I was growing up, I was given the message that I was different and that I wasn't valuable for the community here. And this is indicating to me that that has changed. And he ended up moving back to St. Louis and founding his own company here. And just kind of by happenstance, through word of mouth, hearing that they were seeking a successor and threw his name in the hat. He really credits Fringe for transforming his relationship with his hometown. So I think it's incredibly exciting that, you know, he has a personal history that he's bringing that is so substantially different than mine. You know, he is a local. I'm not. You know, I have ties here. I have family that's from here. But, you know, I'm not of and from this place the way that he is. And so I think he's going to have something really, really different and really substantial to bring that I, by nature, would never really be able to provide. And I'm excited to see what that is. The way that we've set it up is that Matt is the producer of Fringe as of this year. So we have some groundwork that we'd laid, but Matt is officially at the helm of the festival.
Do you care if we play you another audio clip?
Go, let's see. This is fun. It's like a game show.
Little girls shouldn't chew gum. Little girls shouldn't count on their fingers. Little girls shouldn't scream. Little girls shouldn't chew gum.
What's going on here?
That's Paper Glass, Montra performance, Monica Dionisio. She is from actually the same grad program that Matthew Kearns came out of, Naropa University in Boulder, and is also a classically trained performer, exceptionally skilled actor, who has gone to this program to kind of find her own voice.
And she's actually writing on glass. Is that what she's doing?
Yeah. She's writing on. So her show was all about. So the show is actually her. It's a semi-autobiographical story mixed with narrative from Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. And it's about her experience with dyslexia and with learning disability and kind of being told that she's not smart, even though she knows that she is. The piece is about kind of being punished for learning differently and then kind of learning to overcome that. It was a beautiful, beautiful piece. And the room is just like filled with bits of paper. So she spends the whole time like writing on paper and crumpling paper and pulling paper around and like huge paper. Like the room is just like it's part sculpture, part installation, then a performance within that. And she recycles, just for the record. But it's a really, very powerful message.
So this strike resonate with your social work heart?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and any time that people are, you know, whether it's, you know, our first year someone did Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, which
I saw
is
that I loved
Shanley,
that one.
Yeah, it's a classic American, you know, contemporary play, very pivotal in how playwriting is done today. So it's like definitely not an obscure play for people that are in the that kind of dramatic literary world. To something like this that is totally new, totally different, experimental with form. Both of those are viable outlets. So my social work heart is just twanged whenever people twinged, whatever, whenever people are expressing themselves in a way that's meaningful. I will say, I'm going to say this, it's probably uncouth, but whatever, I'm going to say it anyway. I don't like it when I think people are being inauthentic. So, you know, when people are coming up doing something that they feel like they should do, or, you know, I don't know like how to describe it, but every once in a while you kind of see someone that you're like, why are you really here? What are you doing here? And, but that is, it's they are entitled to that platform as much as anybody else to take from it what they intend to take from it and learn from it what they will choose to learn from it.
And there are some things that like are kind of standards in the festival, and we'd like to play a little bit of audio of what that is and just kind of ask you why they might be one of your standards.
Okay.
So that's taiko drumming, mm-hmm. and I hear that it's been a part of the Fringe for a long time. Why is that a repeat customer?
Yeah. Well, the exciting thing about Fringe is that it's all self-directed by the participants. And so it is, they are a staple of Fringe because they've made themselves a staple of Fringe. And the thing that I think is so, that I think, now the interesting thing about taiko is that Fringe is not a great platform for them. They know this, we know this.
Huh.
They are too big. You know, their shows are too big. None of our venues can fit them. You know, like, it's always a pain for them to load in and load out. And they always have to do these, like, abridged versions of their shows because of that. But they value it so much, you know, that they're willing to, like, navigate and work through those hurdles. And we're willing to do that with them. And there's just, like, I think a shared kind of, you know, value system. I'm talking a lot about ethos and value and things like that. But, you know, the first thing that popped in my mind when you played that clip immediately was, you know, I thought about how Fringe is about the cultural identity of St. Louis. And taiko is such a great representation. St. Louis Osawa Taiko is a great representation of that. They're the sister company of the taiko Osawa Japan, where taiko originated. They've traveled back and forth to Osawa. They are very closely tied with the origins. They're one of the preeminent taiko organizations outside of Japan. And they are so proud of their identity in St. Louis and of being a sister city and looking at that cultural relationship and then what St. Louis does to kind of harvest and manifest that cultural within our own community by going to the Japanese festival at the Missouri Botanical Gardens, one of our, like, you know, gems as a city, by getting involved with things like the Fringe Festival of their own volition. And they've come, not only do they come and perform at the Fringe Festival, they've, like, individually come and volunteered and come to shows. And there's just something about what taiko brings out in its participants that's so community-driven that is, in not really any surface-level ways, but in a deeper way, so parallel to what Fringe represents as well. So a lot of his ideas are already being implemented this year, and I think that means that this year is going to be kind of a 50-50 feel, and next year is going to be totally Matt's aesthetic, and I would love to see what he does, not just at the festival, but year-round, you know, the work that we do within the community and how we work with artists and how we work with audiences. I'm very excited to see where he takes that.
That was M. Piro, who founded St. Lou Fringe.
And this year, Fringe actually starts August 19th.
Piro says she'll come back next year in 2017 to see how things are going without her.
Cut and Paste is produced by Nancy Fowler.
And Willis Ryder Arnold.
The music you've heard throughout this was either part of the St. Louis Fringe or made by local musician Eric Hall.
You can find Cut and Paste at stlpublicradio.org or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.